Good morning and welcome to Talking About California, a series of discussions that asks people from California to discuss their home, the state of California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host this morning. I'm director of the Mendocino Institute, a not-for-profit research and education center on the coast. This morning we have the great pleasure to talk with historian, writer, and activist Rebecca Solnit. Rebecca is the author of 13 books now, probably more since we looked last. She writes about ecology, the environment, landscape, community, art, politics, hope, and memory. And most recently, she's written the best-selling Infinite City, a San Francisco Atlas, which I should add is a really splendid volume, and maybe we'll return to that in a bit. Her other books include A Paradise Built in Hell, A Field Guide to Getting Lost, Untold Stories, Wild Possibilities, Wanderlust. She's received the Guggenheim Fellowship, the National Book Critics Circle Award in Criticism, and the Lannan Award. I don't know, you know, if we, it's really difficult to say too much about Rebecca. I hope you don't mind me calling you Rebecca. If you look,
no, not at all.
If you look just at the covers of the books, which you shouldn't do, you should read them, but it's very clear that she's really one of our outstanding writers today and someone that everyone should be familiar with, if not already. So, good morning, Rebecca, again.
And, good morning.
And I wonder if we could just begin with some very general thoughts about a Californian. You told me in a note that you are California educated from kindergarten through the duration. It sounds like you're proud of it. Could you tell us a little bit about becoming a writer and a California writer? I mean, I know you write about lots more than California.
Well, first, a word about the public education business, the California education. I was on a panel a few years ago with two lovely people, but one of them identified himself by Harvard and another one by Princeton, and they're even older than me. And I was like, why are you talking about where you went to college? You know, it's very much an East Coast thing. And then I decided, because funding the California public schools has been so jeopardized the last several decades, that it was important for us public education people to boast about it, too. So from kindergarten to graduate school, I'm a product of the California public education system. I've been in community college, the CSU system, and the UC system, so which, of course, for some people might be grounds to defund it further. But that, you know, that's also about the fact my father was born in California. I was born elsewhere, but we got back here before I was five. And growing up here was a bit like being a colonial subject. There's a wonderful book by Jamaica Kincaid called A Small Place about being a British subject on a Caribbean island and being forced to read all these things that did not describe where she was ecologically or otherwise. And growing up, you were kind of told in those days, things are a bit better now, that nothing really happened in California, that we were this superficial place, that we'd gone from wilderness to shopping mall and a single bound. You know, I'm old enough that we were told, and I hope this is shocking to the younger people, that the native people here were digger Indians. They had no culture. They dug up grubs with sticks, and that was all about all you needed to know about them. And the implication was that they were entirely in the past tense. You know, when it came to the mission system and the incursions of Spain and in Mexico, you know, it was really kind of picturesque stuff, maybe make a mission out of sugar cubes. And so there was very little, you were told very little about where you were. And it just felt to me like even the pictures I saw were New England and Europe. And as a passionate reader, I was always being told that civilization was really European and that you had to go east to get it, that it wasn't here in any sense. And that was a curse of, in a sense, and that you either had to uproot yourself or feel like you were outside the game. But it was also, as I came to become more critical and better educated on my own, kind of a blessing. I'm now really convinced that the United States is several countries, and that whatever it is we are up here in the far west has very little to do with the East Coast and New England, which face Europe, are very linearly descended from Europe, and I think very much bound by European notions in a lot of ways. And just the West Coast, California, you know, where we share a border with Mexico, we used to be Mexico until 1848. The indigenous interior United States never vanished as much here and is strongly present. But also we face Asia. So the influences are really different. And I feel like I've been really lucky in that not so much California history has been written or written well. And that left a huge amount for me to run around and do. And so it's been my pleasure these last 25 years or so to be able to do some of it on my own and find stories that I think are tremendously important, but that have received very little public attention.
Maybe you could say just a quick word about how you got started. What were some of your first interest in writing?
You know, it's really simple. I wanted to be a ballet dancer, and then I went to first grade and learned how to read. And I spent several weeks wanting to be a librarian. And then the next leap was to realize that not only did librarians get to hang out with books all day, but I got to write them. But somebody got to write them, and I decided that was going to be me. And, you know, at that age, books for me had pictures in them. They were best basically fictions, fables, fairy tales. And what exactly I was going to write continued to evolve until by my late teens I was pretty sure it was going to be nonfiction, which wasn't even a word anybody used then. But I was looking at the great Petaluma film critic Pauline Kael and a number of other writers, George Orwell, Borges, from Argentina, and kind of cobbling together a sense of possibilities and desires to pursue. And, you know, and I kept pursuing it. And one thing led to another, and one book led to another.
Well, there's one thing I noticed, you know, in looking, you know, through the collection, and that is you write a lot about places, and but not really, they're not really travel books, but they... You use words like guides, wandering, discovering, getting lost. Could you tell us how you use those kind of ideas?
Yeah, you know, when I was really kind of coming into my own, travel writing was this very big deal in the way that maybe memoir is now. And I'm kind of a contrarian by nature. My second book, Savage Dreams, was definitely influenced by Edward Abbey, but it was written kind of against a lot of the nature writing around me, which really depoliticized and decontextualized the natural world, which, you know, depends on Washington, depends on the chemicals you're putting on your lawn 3,000 miles away. And I wanted to reconnect those things. And with travel writing, I wanted to undo the sense that you go someplace, you're 100% in, you know, Barbados if you're in Barbados, and Tierra del Fuego if you're in Tierra del Fuego, and really look at the ways in which we're present and the ways that place shape us, but also the ways that we're always somewhat somewhere else, that you might be in Ireland, but you're hanging out with someone from Germany, listening to American music and eating Chinese food and dreaming of California, you know, which is more or less something I've done. And so trying to get at what does it, you know, the ways in which we're present, you know, and, or where, you know, or maybe most literally the question, where are we? You know, our feet are in Ireland, our mouth is in China, our ears are somewhere with Johnny Cash, and, you know, our hearts are still in, you know, the oak woodlands of the of Central California. So that kind of complexity of place, and there's a sense for me, too, that place is one of the deep and important relationships you have. We often talk about it in a very kind of rote way of, you know, love of place, but we don't really talk about it the way I think maybe we need to, that it is a real relationship where you have obligations, where what you get back is partly how much you give, and where maybe the place loves you back if you really commit yourself to it and are really involved. And so there's a kind of deep relationship there that matters. It's not exactly like the relationships we have with sentient beings, but, you know, it's as or more important. And so much of who you are is built into the world around you. You know, if you suddenly end up in another country and all that is stripped away, you're really not quite the same person. And, you know, I just spent 2 weeks in Japan where I speak about three words of the language and can't read anything. And it was really interesting having a fairly intense version of being stripped away of all the kind of familiarities and associations and contexts that I'm used to having around me.
One of your titles is intriguing, very interesting, A Field Guide to Getting Lost.
Yeah, that was a title I had for many years before I figured out quite how it was going to organize a set of ideas. The book itself, A Field Guide to Getting Lost, came in part out of my history of walking, wanderlust, where I felt I'd answered some of the questions I'd started the project with, but as always, it had left me with other questions. One set of questions was about technology, speed, the industrialization of everyday life, and the annihilation of time and space. And that I investigated with my biography of Edward Muybridge that came out a couple of years later in 2003. And then in 2005, Field Guide took up the other large body of questions I had after doing the walking book, which was to really investigate and appraise the value of being lost, of meandering, of wandering, of these unquantifiable, immeasurable experiences that are maybe the most important ones, and in a certain sense endangered in a time where we're constantly encouraged to be busy, to be in contact, to be in safe and familiar spaces, and to fill up all the time that might be meditative and solitary with the kind of junk of, you know, earbuds and soundtracks and texting and just, you know, constant input information as though your brain, you know, didn't have anything to do on its own. And when I was writing it, everybody was constantly talking about interactive media. And I was, you know, my attitude was a book is interactive media. You read it and you think, you know, that's the interaction that really matters. I don't really care what your hands are doing or whether you get to push buttons and make choices. You know, that's something, you know, your mind has always been interactive if you're paying attention, and that's where it matters. So A Field Guide was about both senses of loss, about, you know, loss in terms of losing things and about getting lost, about not knowing where you are, about venturing into the unknown, and really the necessity of it in order to discover yourself, to fall in love, to find out where you really are, to find out what you really think, to engage in any kind of creative process. And again, it was a deeply contrarian book, you know, in the era when GPS devices and Garmin devices and all kinds of other things were emerging that suggested you could completely manage your experience, along with all the media suggesting, as local television always likes to, that it's very dangerous to leave your house and maybe you just shouldn't, or you should leave it in those very secured ways involving cars and garage door openers and parking garages or airplanes, rather than maybe just go out on foot under the open sky and not quite know where you are and find out something you might not find out any other way, including what you really think and how you react.
I've always wanted to ask you, do you walk yourself? Are you a wanderer?
Yeah, I walk a great deal. You know, I don't have quite as much time as I used to for it, which I regret. And I also run. I ran on Ocean Beach in San Francisco yesterday evening. You know, I'm probably going to bicycle my errands today. Tomorrow's May Day, and I'll be walking a great deal. And, I walk all the time. One of the joys of being deeply urban for me in San Francisco, the second densest urban area in the United States, is that your feet are actually a pretty good way to get around. And here I'll just be a contrarian to Mendocino County. I've spent a lot of time in rural places, and in some ways urban life feels more natural to me, although small town life can be like that, because everything I need I can walk to. So my body is adequate to cope with the space around me. Whereas the dark secret about rural life is it's very, very car-based for most of the people. And you know that to get milk or mail a letter, you might have to go 10 or 20 or 30 miles. I have friends in Nevada who go 70 miles to the nearest grocery store of, you know, adequate size. And the spaces they live in are wonderful, but traversing them all the time in, you know, a carbon-emitting vehicle, my baby isn't the most natural and organic way to be in space. So cities for me can be very natural because your body, you know, is adequate to navigate many aspects of it. And you can talk about all the unnatural ways that things have been compounded. But, you know, so that's kind of an ideological thing I like. But it's not just, you know, that I do it because I should. When the book came out, lots of people thought I walked because I was dutiful and virtuous. But it's really a pleasure. And, you know, I do it as much as I can and find new routes. And there's a kind of density of texture when you're moving at 3 or 4 miles per hour, things that you notice, eye contact, details, little vignettes that you might not get in a car, or, and not even so much on a bike where you're mostly trying not to be killed and not to wipe out. And so your eyes have really important duties all the time.
People come up to bike in Mendocino County, I often think they're crazy out of their minds, dodging logging trucks and speeding cars. This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow today. I'm hosting a discussion with the writer and historian Rebecca Solnit from San Francisco. So, Rebecca, maybe we could, there are a number of things that I still want to ask you about, but the new volume really is splendid, a beautiful book, Infinite City, a San Francisco Atlas, and it's, I think, very different than what people are used to when they think of city guides or atlases. Was that your idea to do something? And maybe we could talk about one of the neighborhoods you like to talk about.
Yeah, the atlas was something I'd wanted to do for a long time. I'd always loved maps since I was a little kid and reading books, you know, like The Hobbit that have maps in them, and then pretty quickly moved on to real maps of real places. And it wasn't until I completed Atlas and it was out that I found out how much a lot of people love maps, which is one of the reasons I think the book has been successful. There's this ravenous appetite for good-looking, interesting maps that hasn't been fed adequately in a long time. But I was interested in doing a bunch of things. One was to rethink what maps could be in this era of Garmin and Google and GPS devices and using your phone to navigate. You know, maps have kind of atrophied. I think a lot of young people aren't even really accustomed to using them. People use a lot of alternatives to them. And I've had some very interesting experiences. I've been to New Orleans a lot since Hurricane Katrina, and I found somebody gave me a Garmin device as I was starting to go down there, that the Garmin device was very useful at certain times when you just didn't really want to be lost after dark in a strange city that's extremely violent. But you didn't learn anything from that device. It was a kind of authoritarian device whose instructions you followed. Whereas I used the New Orleans map even more, and the more I used it, the less I needed it. I really got to know New Orleans and the layout of the streets and could wing it a little bit, could get lost a little without being hopelessly lost, you know, and then find my way again by landmarks and street names and a general sense of the lay of the land. But I wanted to make maps beautiful the way that they had been 50 and 100 and 200 years ago and just mostly stop being, and I wanted to make them interesting. There's a deep conventionality about the few maps we still get. They mostly show roads and transportation, and maybe they also show shopping and parking. And, you know, you can map a city in terms of migratory birds or heartbreak and romance or, you know, crime and punishment or water systems and food systems, that the roadmap is a very conventionalized version of what the geography, what the actual place is. So I wanted to postulate a bunch of stuff. I wanted to postulate that a place, you know, is inexhaustible because there are infinite versions of it. No two people live in the same place. I like to say, as a kind of spin on the therapist line, that no two people live in the same city, live in the same family. You know, that to be the younger sister is very different than to be the older brother. And, you know, so cities are inexhaustible in that sense. And I wanted to encourage people. It felt like very much a project for an era of climate change, that you can have endless adventures without ever having to go very far. In a place like San Francisco, the whole world is here. We have a huge Samoan population and a pretty significant, you know, Ukrainian population, and there are churches and foods and cultural activities and accents and faces that speak of those things. There are all kinds of things. And I really discovered in the course of starting the Atlas how little I knew of San Francisco. I know a bit more. But the first thing I did is take out one of those conventional road maps and look at it and realize that I literally hadn't been to about 50% of San Francisco. I now feel like I've been to about 3/5 of San Francisco. You know, but a lot of it is still terra incognita, and I still discover things every time I go out and wander. But so I wanted to make beautiful maps. I wanted to make some postulates about place. And I love San Francisco and the Bay Area, and I wanted to map it lovingly but critically. I call the book a Valentine, out, you know, somewhere in the introduction. But it's a very, but it is critical. For example, whether people love or hate the Bay Area, they think it's all peace and love and anti-militarism, et cetera. When Nancy Pelosi became the Speaker of the House, we were constantly hearing about San Francisco values, and everybody knows what the people who deplored San Francisco values meant by that. But San Francisco, it wasn't until they moved across the bay the home of Chevron. It's still the home of Bechtel. It's where KSFO, the conservative station that gave the world Michael Savage, is. It's where one of the architects of the torture memos, Jay Bybee, sits on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals at UC Berkeley, which everybody thinks about as, you know, radicals in the free speech movement. John Yoo, another torture architect for the Bush administration, is tenured at the law school. University of California, Berkeley, manages the entire nuclear weapons labs complex of the United States and had a huge role in the making of the first atom bomb. That's where some of the major physicists came from, and it's always had these ties. You know, the hydronuclear bomb was developed at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory in the eastern East Bay, and Silicon Valley is the brain trust for the Pentagon. You know, that's where a lot of the new technologies are developed, and the new Silicon Valley has always been very closely tied since its birth to militarism. I mean, this is the military-industrial complex. And the Hoover Institute is there, Lockheed Martin is there, Northrop Grumman is there, you know, the maker, the designer of the Bradley fighting vehicle is there. There's the headquarters for one of the CIA rendition flights contractors. You know, so I wanted to show people the place, warts and all, in ways that maybe they didn't know it, and to complicate the kind of easy familiarity people have when they think that they know a place, whether they've been there for a brief vacation or all their life.
And the Atlas is also very much about history and change and how change comes about. Could you say a word about the Fillmore District? It's a very moving piece in the book.
I moved into the Western Addition, which includes the Fillmore District, when I was very young, and it was this extraordinary neighborhood. You know, I moved there in 1981 as a teenager, and it was still in the, you know, urban renewal had happened with the absolute brutality of that process that had been nicknamed Negro removal. And it had destroyed this, you know, had destroyed the Fillmore, and, you know, they bulldozed all these incredibly beautiful Victorian houses by claiming they were blighted, which was this code word then for poor people, you know, and it was really about slumlords. You could have just enforced code and made the landlords fix them up. But it was part of that kind of modernist mania of sanitizing and suburbanizing cities as much as possible. It's where the big Geary Boulevard expressway comes from, where they cleared a lot of stuff out. And, you know, and it had only been a African-American neighborhood since World War II. Before that, it was Japanese and Jewish, particularly, and the Japanese were all, you know, forcibly incarcerated during World War II, which created this sort of empty space African Americans filled. And then it became what's sometimes called the Harlem of the West, a place with a huge number of nightclubs and restaurants and juke joints and theaters and things like that, and this very vibrant society, and that's what was being destroyed and called blighted. And my first book was about the visual artists who were part of beat culture in the 1950s, and close to some of the poets like Michael McClure. And you always hear about the Beats as being in North Beach, but that's kind of preposterous. And there was a little bit of that sitting around in Italian coffee houses and drinking, you know, early era lattes. But a lot of these people were living in the Fillmore district. And when I wrote this book about them when I was very young, I learned a lot about them, about this place, from the people themselves who'd been there in the 50s and 60s. And, of course, I was living among a lot of African-Americans who'd been pushed from the center to the periphery. You know, so I wanted to map a bunch of things with this map, which I'm looking at now. And I should say the designer, Leah Chandra at UC Press, made this a really beautiful, beautiful book, delicate palettes from different set of colors for each map, beautiful borders and fonts and title plates. Half the maps have art by artists I selected. This one is a tall, thin map on one side of the spread, so there's a wonderful Rorschach blot by my friend Jan Sturgeon, who works at City Lights, on the other side. But I wanted to capture a bunch of things. One thing that fascinates me is the way that a long street or a bus route is often a core sample through a city. Fillmore Street starts out in a very posh neighborhood and goes up over Pacific Heights, sometimes called Specific Whites, the really affluent neighborhood where people like Dianne Feinstein live. And then it drops down into what was, you know, in the post-war era, this very poor, vibrant black neighborhood. And there's still a strong African-American presence. It's getting more and more gentrified. And you can, which you can tell by geography, what used to be the Upper Fillmore is now Lower Pacific Heights and what it gets called. And it runs all the way down almost to Market Street. You know, it's about 3 miles long. And, you know, it goes all the way to Haight Street, and it's just a few blocks after that. And it's a neighborhood that also has a lot, or a street that crosses a lot of cultural and spiritual territory, some important historic sites, some of the relics of the 60s and 70s in good and bad ways, the People's Temple, where Jim Jones had his multi-ethnic congregation. He got to South America and forced into mass suicide. For, you know, maps become out of date very quickly. The Church of St. John Coltrane, which had been pushed off to Visadero Street by gentrification, was on Fillmore Street when I did the map. I'm not sure it's there anymore. And, you know, I also made a point of doing something on this map that I didn't do the same way on others, which is I made the past and the present indistinguishable, so that, you know, the 19th century and the 20th century and the 21st century are all just kind of coexisting as they do on maps. And, you know, so that's this beautiful yellow and green map with a big Rorschach blot echoing the long line of the street and its black labels.
One map that's beautiful in the way that you're describing all the maps is the map of the Mission, but a fascinating aspect of the map is that at the bottom of the Mission, there's the Mexican border. How did that happen?
That was my idea. Making maps is very powerful because even more than writing, you know, these are pictures of the world that people trust in some sense. And so it was amazing to find out that I had this power. But I wanted to really show two things. And this map got too cluttered. I don't feel it's entirely successful. But I wanted to show the coexistence of inner city kids alongside day laborers, which is to say kids who might speak Spanish at home, whose parents might be immigrants, but who live so locally that a lot of them have not been to Golden Gate Park, a lot of them have not been to Ocean Beach, but the neighborhood they live in is very dense with safe and dangerous spaces, your enemies, your allies, where you were baptized and did First Communion, and where your aunt lives and where your dad works, and, you know, and so you have these kids who are hyper-local, we call Latino, and then there are these other people we call Latino who are the day laborers. And these people have traveled the way Odysseus has traveled, and very few of us middle-class people will ever travel. You know, they've walked for days across the desert and seen death and dying. They've been arrested and injured and paid coyotes to smuggle them. You know, they've gone through these extraordinary experiences. Sometimes they really love the adventure, as Adriana found out. Sometimes they're just kind of doggedly dedicated to trying to keep their family back home afloat. And when, with all the anti-immigration rhetoric you hear, one of the things you don't hear is that these are very hardworking people sending money back to Mexico and other countries they come from, which is why one of the other things Adriana Camarena, who did a lot of the research on this map, put there is the remittance shops, which are the places where you send wire transfers back to your wife or your mother, you know, or their bank account, or you know, and this is the place where Western Union is still alive. And so I really just wanted to show the strong presence of these groups of people. And Adriana got very focused on the kids in gangs. It was a wonderful adventure for her too. I asked her to do the work, and she's a Mexico City native, married to a white guy living in the mission. And it sort of forced her to leave the white middle-class mission and enter the Latino mission and the working-class mission in a way she hadn't before, to speak to these people mostly in Spanish and get to know them and see this other world living in the same place, which is very much what this project is about, is, you know, one of my definitions of a city that Atlas tries to portray as many worlds in the same place. And Adriana's extraordinarily charming and diplomatic and bold. So she got to know a bunch of day laborers. At one point, she was making sandwiches and bringing them down for the guys, because when you don't get lunch, when you don't get work, you don't get food a lot of the time. And these guys are really living hand to mouth. She ended up helping some of the gang kids, their ex-gang kids, in different ways and getting involved in their lives. And but she has guts. She walked into the mission police station and asked them for a map of the gang territories, and they got it. And so one of the things you see on this map is the gang territories, and you see that the Sureños, which means southerners, they're north of the Norteños, they're northerners, because the names come from Los Angeles and come from prisons, and they don't describe this geographical reality, describe a more metaphysical reality. And then I put the border in because there was no reason to show what was south of the mission that we were portraying. But also I would suggest the way that the day laborers who stand on Cesar Chavez Boulevard at the end of the southern border of the mission live in relationship to the border. And so that was a part of the map. I think we put too much stuff on the map and it's a little cluttered, and I kind of wish we could do it all over again. But putting the border on was really exciting for me, just seeing the way that places exist in relationship to each other, which you can say and say and say, but to see with this border, you know, with the kind of familiar point of southern Texas on it and a little bit of Mexico at a completely different scale below, was really exciting. And on the border, we put the points at which a lot of the people, several of the people Adriana talked to, had crossed. So you also have all these border crossings. So maybe it is a good portrait of a world, but it has, you know, it takes a lot of sorting out to read. But it is a lovely pumpkin color. The Sureños are blue. The Norteños are red, which are kind of their gang colors. Mexico is kind of olive green. And this map was too busy for art, but it had some beautiful quotes from some of the people Adriana talked to. Can I read one by Elsa, a 19-year-old?
Sure, please do.
She was born at San Francisco General, so she was even born literally in the neighborhood, in a big public hospital. And she told Adriana for the Atlas, "Communities are made by people who go through the same situations. They bond through the same struggles. It's about the people. It's about the people you grow up with and the place in which you feel comfortable. I kind of want to be here forever in the mission. It is sunny sometimes, the warmest place in the city. I do want to go to other countries to help people. I do want to travel. I like learning in order to satisfy that hunger within myself. I also want to work with homeless people in poverty, with something we can fix." This was this 19-year-old, and I ended up helping her and a friend come up with the money to drive around California, look at four-year colleges they might go to. And they were just lovely, lovely, lovely kids. You know, it was one of the joys of this project. that I think is somewhat available to the reader, but even more available to us making the map, as it drew us into all these different worlds of, you know, that people live in, immigrants and inner city kids and laborers and historians and experts on butterflies and experts on gay bars and people who remember what happened to the Fillmore District and, African-American musical histories and just so much more. And it's a book of 22 maps, a tall, you know, you referred to me as writing the book, I should say. It's got 22 maps, and every map was a collaboration with cartographers and a designer, often also with researchers, writers, and in half the cases, artists I commissioned to make the maps. Beautiful and imaginative the way 18th and 19th century maps with art in them were. So photographers, painters, people making drawings. And so it was really more that I directed the atlas than I wrote it, although I wrote about half of the essays in it. There's 19 essays as well as 22 maps.
And this is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow. Our program is talking about California. Today we're very lucky to be in conversation with Rebecca Solnit, and she's just been talking about a marvelous new volume called Infinite City, a San Francisco Atlas, published by the University of California Press. I should, you know, add an atlas, a guide to San Francisco without hotels, without prices, without restaurants. An atlas which will really capture your interest and attention. I think listeners will know, we said at the beginning that you wrote about art and politics and hope. Is there anything explicit that you would like to say about how you connect a political vision with your writing, with your ideas about hope and memory? And
you know, one of the most rewarding and meaningful parts of my life for the last, it's 9 years now, has been writing for the website TomDispatch.com, which is not a blog or an aggregator site like Truthout or Common Dreams, but it really works like a wire service. We put out 3 essays a week, and they go around the world, picked up by all kinds of places. And the things I write for him, it really doesn't feel like I go looking for them. It's like they kidnap me. I get an itch to write. We work out, you know, we talk about it, and I write something. I have something about May Day, for example, that I got inspired to write called Welcome to the 2012 Hunger Games, about what we're doing to the young and kind of the grounds for resistance. So, you know, it feels very natural to me. I was what was considered a weird kid or a misfit in elementary school and thereafter. And, you know, I do what makes most sense to me, which is partly trying to make a kind of writing in which the poetic and the political, or the personal and the public, aren't separate, to connect the patterns that I see. And I think a lot of my work is about trying to see the bigger patterns of what kind of power do we have? How have we changed the world? How could we change the world? What do we have in common? What are these patterns and places that connect us? What are the stories that don't get told? What other ways are there to look at these things all around us? But really, it almost feels like the work comes looking for me. I don't go looking for it. So what I do feels like the most natural thing in the world for me to do.
So you've written some books that are strictly political, I guess you'd say. Was The Battle of Seattle, is that one of your books?
That's really a book my brother David did, and it was funny to find out that an anarchist press like AK cared about marketing. I helped David with the more pragmatic side of editing. I'm still good at spelling and punctuation and grammar and editing things down to size and organizing them. You know, I do it with some of my friends as well as always doing it with my own pieces. I worked as an editor when I was young, which is great training for any writer. But it was really David's concept, and he pulled it together. But I do have an essay in there as well about my, and this is a book, I should say, about the misunderstanding of what happened in 1999 in Seattle, which David was a key organizer of and I was a participant in. There's a right-wing myth that it was that we were violent and brutal, and that's been used to justify cracking down on activists ever since. You know, there's like my essay is really about my battle with the New York Times, which referenced during their coverage of the Republican National Convention in New York in 2004 the widespread arson in Seattle. And there was no arson in Seattle. One dumpster caught fire. Maybe somebody threw tear gas grenade or something in it that the police threw. Maybe somebody dropped a cigarette. But the notion of widespread arson, you know, and violent activists is a pernicious myth, like the myth of anti-war activists and the Vietnam era spitting and returning soldiers' faces. It just didn't happen. There's an equally pernicious myth on the left that David wanted to try and counter, which is the myth that it all just kind of magically happened and was this beautifully spontaneous uprising, and you just issue a call for something to happen, and then magically it happens. He wanted people to know how hard they worked to build alliances, to plan strategy and tactics, to work out differences between groups, to build giant puppets and get the word out and bring people in and make contacts around the world. There was that Batita Martinez, Where Was the Color in Seattle, article in 1999. But there were connections made with people in Europe, but also people in India, people in Latin America, in what was becoming an extraordinarily powerful movement. So David put the book together to counter both the myth of activist violence and the myth of spontaneous flowering. And, and I was delighted to work with him. We've been working very closely together all our somewhat adult lives. And he's a great activist. You know, I'm good at getting lost in the clouds or wandering all the way to the top of the ivory tower. And David's always one way or another in the street and very good at keeping me connected to it up through this very moment with Occupy San Francisco, which he's been doing fantastic work with around foreclosure defense and other kinds of organizing.
And he was involved in the big anti-Iraq war movement at the beginning, wasn't he?
Yeah, we both were. But David's I'm an activist, but David's more than that. He's an organizer who gets activists coordinated and informed and mobilized and all those important things, since, you know, sometimes these things happen spontaneously in moments of outrage and stuff, but, we need organizers. And, but he's been involved since his late teens at the beginning of the 1980s in anti-nuclear human rights, anti-war, environmental and other causes, and anti-militaristic things. He's worked a lot for Bradley Manning and with Iraq Veterans Against the War. He's the co-author of a book with Amy Allison, formerly of KPFA, called Army of None, about counter-recruitment of young people to keep them out of the army. And, he's actually the author of three books, of three anthologies, including Globalized Liberation, a WTO era handbook about activism and organizing. So, he's the organizer, but I get into the streets and I'm the writer, but he's quite productive for someone who's always saying he's not a writer.
Well, we don't have too much time left, and I've got a couple of big questions for you. So you don't mind shifting a little bit, could you tell us about a California bestiaria? It's another marvelous, beautiful little volume, which I hope readers will find their way to as soon as possible. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, the first thing to say is that it was a project that began with the wonderful Malcolm Margolin, publisher of Heyday Books, one of California's great treasures, by which I mean both Malcolm and the press. If people don't know it, it puts out environmental, native Californian, literary and visual books that are just wonderful. And the press and Malcolm really exist at the point of intersection of all those things. But he was talking to the Oakland Zoo, which is a really good zoo. They take in a lot of animals that have been damaged by circuses and private owners, and they're very humane. You know, I know zoos sometimes get a bad rap. They've pioneered humane and really even kind of egalitarian ways to work with and take care of elephants and things. So this was a collaboration with them as they developed, you know, their native California displays. But, you know, I didn't work with them that much, but, you know, except I had some wonderful visits with various people. But so I was the one where they talked about the book in general, or because I spent a lot of time sort of, you know, puttering around in the Middle Ages as a, you know, young person, college student, and thereafter. I was like, oh, you want a bestiary, which are these wonderful medieval guides to books that are very magical, sometimes literally, in that they talk about the unicorn horn that cures poisoning and, you know, the basilisk with the stone in its head and all these kind of supernatural animals or supernatural properties or spiritual allegories that animals have. It's a wonderful model. So we decided we're doing a California bestiary, and I got the wonderful artist Mona Carone, who also did one of the most beautiful maps in the Atlas, to work with me. She did the illustrations, I did the text, and I got to pick the 12 animals. It was really an interesting challenge because California is the world in miniature. You know, we have our alpine and harsh desert and, you know, lush coast and rainforest and grassland. We have everything here. We have lots of species that occur nowhere else. You know, we have reptiles, insects, birds, mammals, and all kinds in every category. So it was really fun and tricky trying to balance in all the categories, different parts of the state, species that are endangered or extinct and that are so common people hardly think about them, like blue-bellied lizards, which are one of my great loves, charismatic, beautiful things and things maybe people don't think about so much, and, you know, like the California ground squirrel, fairly unglamorous animal for most people who see it, but don't really know that it actually is this remarkable animal that's immune to rattlesnake venom and will fight rattlesnakes and is the main food for a lot of raptors, which is why you have these great raptor populations. And, I'm going off on the ground squirrel, but it was really fun, and Mona did the most wonderful illustrations where she made the animals quite charming.
Could I ask you...
this very small book, but portrayed... Yes?
Rebecca, could I ask you to read a bit? Would you mind... do you have the book handy there?
Yes, I do.
I think you suggested the blue-bellied lizard.
Yes, okay.
And so this is coming from the volume A California Bestiary by Rebecca Solnit.
The bestiaries, or books of beasts, of almost 1,000 years ago contained much we no longer believe. There is no stone in the head of toads that neutralizes poison, and there are no unicorns at all, so the ability of their horns to likewise undo poison is not particularly helpful either. Those old books were compendiums of known and imagined animals, of eagles and dragons and elephants, with lore about their powers, lives, and meanings, often moral and religious meanings. They're also compendiums of sheer wonder, where the sense of wonder that emerges from scientific knowledge is at least as great, whether it's about the Belding's ground squirrel of the Sierra Nevada that hibernates about 8 months a year, or the elephant seal that not only can hold its breath underwater for an hour, but often does so for 20 minutes or more at a time while sleeping on the shore, or the blue whale whose heart is bigger than an American bison and beats about 6 times a minute, a tenth the speed of ours, or the hummingbird in flight whose tiny heart beats 1,000 times a minute. Toads can't counteract poison, but blue-bellied lizards, it is now known, have a mysterious property in their blood that eliminates Lyme disease from the infected ticks in their nymph stages that bite them. This may be why the West Coast is so much less infested with this pernicious disease than the East. The bluebelly's blood is now as marvelous as the toadstone then, but it's important to celebrate the bluebelly for its own sake, for its 20 long toes as delicate as eyelashes, for its ball-bearing eyes, for its grainy camouflaging stripes in tones of dust and shadow, for the secret blue bands of its white underside, 2 long vertical lines and more blue on its chin, ranging from a soft sky blue in the young and female lizards to a fierce azure that saturates the males in red. The official English name of this creature is the Western Fence Lizard, but they were all over the West millennia before fences were, and the California kids I knew called them bluebellies. Bluebellies were everywhere in the California hills when I was growing up, darting away from us, sometimes like many other lizard species, shedding their tails when one of my brothers tried to catch them, so that the tail stayed behind, flapping frantically, a tactic thought to have evolved to distract predators. I've seen thousands of bluebellies, held dozens, perhaps hundreds, but only twice have I seen the intensely blue males and rut fight each other, scrabbling and separating and gripping, doing push-ups on the rocks between times. The push-ups display their blue undersides and are thought to impress females. Once they're under live oaks on Mount Tamalpais near the Golden Gate, once they're on the warm granite of the trail up Little Yosemite Canyon, both times I watched until all sense of scale fell away, and I might as well have been watching sapphire dragons. But it's not the exceptional moments or exceptional beasts that are grounds for wonder. The everyday bluebelly found everywhere in California by the deep deserts and highest mountains is, with its purifying blood, its underside of sky, its speed and its talent for survival, already a small astonishment.
Thank you. That was Rebecca Solnit reading from her book, California Bestiary. We have time for one more question, and I think I've been asking you really about some of the titles of your books, but another one that stands out is A Paradise Built in Hell, and I think that that book explores some of the things that you find hopeful in difficult, turbulent times.
Yeah, A Paradise Built in Hell has the subtitle Extraordinary Communities That Arise in Disaster. The book itself arises first out of my own experience in the Loma Prieta earthquake and the great drought of 76-77, realizing that people didn't mind privation. They did, you know, that they really, there were ways people came together in crisis that they found so meaningful. They were quite joyous, even though, you know, we always think that we're miserable and terrified or, you know, in crisis and that we need to get over it as soon as possible. And certainly, you know, I'm not in favor of disasters and death and suffering, but I am really intrigued by the way people respond. And, you know, this came up again when I read a huge number of firsthand accounts of the 1906 earthquake and found out how different that and then how different every disaster is from what we've been told. The book is called A Paradise Built in Hell because disasters are really hell. People die, people are injured, people lose things. You know, I don't think disasters are good. But the paradise is the communities, the way that people to come together or pull themselves together to respond. You often see remarkable capacities that might not be evident at other times. People who are unemployed or have, you know, very little standing, you know, become heroes and rescuers. They find, you know, everybody finds new work, new urgency, new meaning, new connections. The kind of things we spend most of our lives worrying about suddenly don't matter anymore. So there's a kind of transcendence to the moment where, you know, you're just not gonna, all the clutter has gone that we busy our lives with, you know. What do we look like? What do people think of us? What, you know, was our mother nice enough in 1974? And what are we going to do in 10 years' time? You know, you're in this intensified present. So, and it was really a project that grew and grew and grew. I was just curious about the joy when I began. And as I went in deeper, the project became much more hopeful than I expected it to be. And an extraordinary window onto social possibility in human nature. We're told over and over that we're social creatures of social Darwinism, that we're creatures of Hobbes, that we're basically selfish and competitive and chaotic. That's the version of human nature that justifies authoritarianism, a strong state, authority figures with their implicit and explicit threats of violence keeping us in line. And the assumption has always been by these people who believe this, namely the authorities who think that they're absolutely necessary, that without them we're nothing, without them we're chaotic, we're nothing but raping and pillaging. But you look at a disaster where all the systems that normally kind of keep things running suddenly cease to exist. And what do people do? They are much better than they ordinarily are in many ways. That partly it's this opportunity to flower. And, you know, so it's a remarkable window onto human nature. both in the sense that people do remarkable things. They're heroic, they're brave, they rescue each other, they improvise the conditions of their survival very creatively and energetically and resourcefully. But the joy is what's really interesting, that not only are we capable of this, but it's something we really want, that made me see that in some ways it's everyday life that's a disaster for so many of us, a disaster of meaninglessness and trivialization and alienation. And a society where all people's, I think, more deep social and political and spiritual needs were met, a disaster would just be a disaster. But it's because our societies are mostly something of a disaster themselves that even a disaster can become a liberation from the status quo. I should also say disasters often unfold very much like revolutions, in that the authorities are no longer in charge. People are improvising their own government. They're essentially governing themselves. And this is quite terrifying to the authorities, which is part of why they tend to misinterpret what's happening and behave so badly. And it's partly that they want to restore the status quo, in which they're extremely powerful, and they don't always succeed. This is one of the ways the book is very different than Naomi Klein's disaster capitalism book, The Shock Doctrine, where she looks at how they try and seize power. But my point was that we also seize power, which is why they're pushing back. And sometimes they win, but sometimes we win. And that's a really important thing to know. I should also add that this book is part of Cal Humanities' statewide Democracy Reads project, and I should be coming up to the Mendocino Public Library sometime in October, which is going to have a bunch of programming around the book as part of a public conversation on democracy I'm thrilled to be part of.
Oh, that's terrific. I'm afraid we've run out of time, Rebecca, but I'd like to thank you again very much.
My pleasure.
On behalf of KZYX and on our listeners and supporters. And we'll tell listeners as well that this program is talking about California. My name is Cal Winslow, and we'll be back with another installment Thursday at 9 a.m. Thanks, Rebecca.
You're welcome, Cal.
Good
Take
morning.
Care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.